Hello.
And welcome back to the welcome back of...
This is not
a history
lecture. You caught me off guard with that one. This is a good one.
Thank you. Yeah. I was ready for that one. We just had a wonderful dinner.
Yes, nice little dinner break.
Mm-hmm.
And we are on to recording our second episode for the day. Yes. So this one will come out February 13th, and it is February 4th when we're recording this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so...
Which means that one of us has a Valentine's-y themed thing.
Yes, yes. I am doing the history of Valentine's Day and how it got from its origins to what it is now.
How romantic.
Yes. What are you doing?
I am talking about something I highly doubt you've ever heard of, and I don't mean that in like a bad way. It's just that I had never heard of it. It's New Zealand's pink and white terraces.
You're right. I have never heard of that.
I had not either.
Pink and white, that's kind of Valentine's-y.
I know. It was unintentional. But nonetheless, I think it'll be a great way for us to have some fun, almost themes to talk about.
Yep.
And if you want to learn more, you can stick around and find out why.
This is not a history lecture with Kat and Kaylee.
Okay, so let's get going. I mean, it's our second episode here. I say let's jump into it. Yes. I am very intrigued by your pink and white terraces. Please do tell.
Okay, so for anyone who is not interested necessarily in geography or cool geographic features.
Which if you aren't, boo.
You decide to skip over it with my little summary. Pink and white terraces are a geological... Well, we're a geological outcropping in New Zealand that were very prevalent for tourists in the 19th century and are now subject of discussion and suspicion.
Oh, okay.
So if you want to figure out what that's all about, you stick around. So the pink and white terraces are sometimes known as the Fountain of the Clouded Sky. They've got some nicknames and everything because they were supposed to be completely beautiful. They existed among the original, like, cultural stories of New Zealand. So we know that they, like, they have a... Sorry, Kitty makes me laugh with the little claws. We know that they were prominent in the culture of New Zealand before colonizers arrived. These pieces of earth, this terraced pink and white structure, natural structure, was so beautiful. They were considered to be the eighth wonder of the world. And they sat along the shores of Lake Rotomahana, where the largest silica center deposits known on earth. So, I'm not a sciencey geology person, but I feel like we did a decent job a couple weeks ago on our geological disaster stuff. So I'm trusting my science a little more these days.
Nice.
Not my numbers, because I botched numbers last week, but maybe science. So essentially, they're geothermal springs that kind of got pushed to the surface, the water did. And the water that was being held there it's an interesting composition, or we think it was an interesting composition. Again, a lot of this is subject because, spoiler alert, we don't have them anymore. The water might have had chloride in it. We think it was chloride, but that the pH of it was almost so neutral that it was relatively safe for people to be in, and that they became widely known as a tourist thing, but specifically as bathing pools.
Yeah.
Although we think there was a lot of silica in it that gave it this very distinct appearance. They form along a notable ridge, this geothermal like vent that was producing this water, where there's a lot of other geothermal features, whether that be like geysers, volcanoes. There's a lot of just activity along that ridge in New Zealand. Yeah. And this water would come to the surface, and over thousands of years, or a thousand years maybe, depending on what geologists and what histories and suspicions and speculations you're reading, they formed over that very long period of time, although the active water there may have been around for much longer. There's kind of two distinct sections of it. The pink terraces were called, and I'm trying really hard, Unfortunately, Maori, like, dialect is not something that is commonly heard in America, and I apologize. I looked it up, but it's just not something that my...
Yeah, you're...
That, like, I know very well.
You're
so
familiar with, yeah.
I'm working with the best pronunciation I had available. The pink terraces were called Te Otukapaurangi, which means the fountain of the clouded sky. And we think that that pinkish color originated from something like arsenic sulfide, maybe some gold or iron or manganese. Thank you. That one took a second.
Don't hurt yourself.
In the water, because the water in these pink terraces was clearer, but the way that these terraces formed was from deposits, like the sediment deposits and chemical deposits in the water. So whatever created that pink color had to be a product of what was in, like the stone structure, kind of like stalagmites and stalactites. So whatever was forming these, the hardened earth around it had to be from the water. These pools also had the water was a little bit clearer, which made it more of a tourist destination. But the temperature also varied a bit more between the pools. So it was kind of like you can bounce from pool to pool. You can feel the temperature decrease or increase as you go, et cetera, et cetera. But less than a mile away is the other terrace. The other terrace is the white one. It's the larger of two, and it was called Te Tarata, which means tattooed rock. It covers about 20 acres and had about 50 different layers. They created this individual pools that all connected and flowed together. Fed by the Te Tarata spring at the top of the feature, and the water poured downwards. So it's kind of hard to explain this. So if you want to Google a picture, you can. But the water starts at the top. The terraces were somewhere around 1,000 years old, but the hydrothermal properties were thousands of older than that. So over these many years, the silica is building up in these individual pools. The water starts at the top and flowed down. The deposits created a sort of individual pool, like a lip around the edge of it to retain it. And then when the water got to be more than that, it would spill over the side and drop down to below it and create another pool below that over and over and over again until you had like 50 different layers up on top of each other. So think like infinity pools nestled on top of each other. That the water at the top is still reaching the bottom in almost a fountain like huge fountain like sort of thing.
That would be
like watching clouds, like watching rain, watching water. Like it would be so incredible. Some of the formations, from what we have of people's records and suspicions, we think that not only did they occur because of water pooling and building deposits, but also possibly that basilica steps sometimes formed on their well just from the water running over them and creating deposits almost more like stalagmites instead. But there was a Victorian novelist named Anthony Trollope.
What a trollop.
There's an E on the end. And I do, again, want to thank World Encyclopedia, because they come in clutch with some really cool stuff.
Love them.
And he bathed in some of the pools in 1874. And he said, "You go from one bath to another, trying the warmth of each. The water trickles from one above to the one below, coming from the vast boiling pool at the top. And the lower, therefore, are less hot than the higher. The baths are shell-like in shape, like vast open shells, the walls of which are concave and the lips ornamented in a thousand forms. Four or five may sport in one of them, each without feeling the presence of the other. I have never heard of other bathing like this in the world." So, like, you could have a few people in each one.
Yeah.
Like, and still be, like, they're so big. In these, like, individual shell-like features that they're so big that you didn't even have to be bothered by someone else in the pool with you. Jeez. Like, they're massive. And then 50 of those all on top of each other. Yeah. So, like, that tells you a lot.
That's insane.
And
oh, my God.
This is New Zealand. So, even the colonizers got there eventually. It had... The Maori people were in the area before, like, colonizers ever got there.
Right.
And it had a lot of cultural significance. The Maori people considered them to be a treasure, or a toanga, I believe it's pronounced, in their words. They had a cultural understanding of them that the white terrace was male and the pink terrace was female. and that the whole area was important. In, like, all of the geothermal activity around there was kind of, it makes, it's like the Ring of Fire. It's mm-hmm. almost like an archipelago, or I can never say that word. Archipelago. Thank you.
Yep.
Kind of like all one connected chain. And they were all pretty important to them, including Mount Tarawera, which is part of a volcanic plateau.
Mm-hmm.
But the mountain itself, Mount Tarawera, is where the Iwi, or the local people, would bury their ancestors. So this mountain was like a sacred place to them.
Yeah.
Of course, colonization eventually gets there, and even though the Europeans weren't allowed out there, like, they were told, like, hey, you're not allowed up here, this is, like, our space, this is taboo, there were missionaries that felt entitled to go places they weren't supposed to be or weren't welcome, and so eventually Europeans did get into those spaces and make their presence known. But eventually, the first Europeans would visit and exploit it and make it popularized in its own way. The first, like, notable European that documented things that visited Rodemahana was led by Ernst Dieffenbach, who noted it during a survey for the New Zealand Company in the summer of 1841. We haven't talked a ton about New Zealand. Neil, you did a thing on New Zealand colonization, but I mean, we've, like, mentioned it in passing, but we've never had, like, a dedicated episode for it. But it's important to note that that New Zealand is a colony for the British Empire. It's more remote than a lot of the other areas nearby, which may have spared it from some of the British's more imperialist pursuits, because, like, they couldn't just get there in a week,
right?
And, like, you know, let's like build farms and stuff here, like, let's do this. But nonetheless, it still took people quite a while to get out there if they wanted to. So people would, like, travel months to come see this thing that this one guy had just written about in a book. So you know this guy had to have written a really glowing review.
People
were like, yes, I am from the British Empire. I will be traveling months and months to go see this thing with my posh time off or whatever. So, like, he had to have been...
It's like how they used to... People used to, like, go explore the world or whatever.
You had to be rich to just, like, not work to go explore the world and everything. But this book that he wrote about it in was essentially kind of like a travel guide. So it exposed the wonder to this wonder of the world to the outside people. Regardless of the fact that it was more remote than the other British imperial pursuits. Tourism skyrockets, obviously. But, like, even with the remoteness of it, it skyrockets, but that does limit the demographic a little bit. The only people that can, like, afford to take that time off of work and afford that voyage and everything, it's usually wealthier people, especially those who could afford to travel. Usually male, because that kind of journey wasn't all like, oh, let's take trains to get here. There were some, like, rough parts of that travel that wouldn't have been considered suitable necessarily for women, although there were women that, like, visited and everything. It just wasn't, like, something the wealthy upper class women were as likely to do as men,
right?
Because men got to do their little travel around the world and like all that jazz,
so their oats or whatever.
Sometimes officers from the Navy would end up going there, and in a kind of higher proportional rate, just because you had to get there by ship and everything. And no matter your money, it was still a pretty complex way to travel. It would take months to get there by ship from Europe, but it wasn't just a straight shot. You had to go through a bunch of different legs and transports, like everything from, like, hey, you gotta come in on a ship, and then you gotta take a train to this one place, but they don't have any trains after that, so you have to take, like, a wagon, and then from there you gotta take a canoe across this river, but then you gotta walk it a little while, so you gotta find someone to get you, like, a horse. And then, like, it was just a very complex, it was not a leisure visit, it was like I'm traveling the world, et cetera, et cetera. You also had to, if you wanted to get to the pools themselves, you could visit New Zealand, but if you wanted to get to the pools, you needed a local person to be your guides. Notably, the two most popular were guide Sophia, whose name was Sophia Henarangi, and guide Kate, who was named Kieta Rangituhia Middle Mass. Both of them were very fluent, or were fluent in English, and it made them very popular among tourists. Mm-hmm. So this industry, this tourism, was pretty lucrative for the people in the area that benefited from it, the proper, like guides and mm-hmm. people who were going to house these visitors and everything. Yeah. But there's a drawback to tourism as well. There's the exploitation, of course, of the actual physical site. And you can't have nice things when tourists are involved. Visitors had started to carve their names into the silica deposits, take things like native feathers and flowers from the area that were covered in silica, that were part of the cultural existence there. And mm-hmm. notably, Queen Victoria's son, Alfred, wrote his own name on a terrace wall. There's some mm-hmm. irony there about, like, British imperialism and putting your name places it doesn't yeah. belong.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's... I feel like that's just really on the nose, and you
yeah,
can see
yeah,
that
you can
one.
See the mm-hmm. you can see the metaphor there. I don't need to make it's pretty that. Obvious. Yeah. yeah.
So the drawbacks obviously are like exploitation of the space.
Mm-hmm.
Colonization is the way that we have a lot of photographs though of this space.
Mm.
I don't think we have any in color. Everything we have so far that I think has been found has been black and white.
Yeah.
So we don't know photograph-wise what color it was, but we do have quite a few drawings and paintings from artists who went out there to specifically paint this
yeah.
because it was so beautiful. That's kind of how we estimate the color, and scientists have suggested, like, hey, what would make that color chemically? Like, what's available right. in this region? What could have done that? The maps that we do have of this region as well are mostly pieced together from what colonizers had mm-hmm. done, from their attempts to map things and note their travels.
Yeah.
We actually don't have any Maori maps or
yeah.
anything like that. They relied on their guides who knew the way. It's kind of
yeah.
like oral history. Like, it's
yeah.
passed down and entrusted from person to person. Like,
right.
Why write it down when, like,
right.
you have guides? Like, that's
you
part
know
of
how
your
to get there.
Community.
Why would you write it down?
Yeah.
yeah.
But we do have some topographic mapping as well that tells us the height of the pools,
mm-hmm.
Which topographic mapping, if it's been a little while since you've been in a science class, it's the one where it's like they look like little circles or misshapen rings layered inside each other that tell you the height of objects.
Mm-hmm.
That's how we kind of know how tall some of these pools were, that and the existing accounts from people who were able to give it after the fact.
Yeah.
A lot of the Maori people, I mean, they didn't need maps, like I said, because they lived near it. It was part of their culture. And a lot of them lived nearby Mount Tarawera. And a lot of them kind of fed into or, like, found a way to benefit from that tourism and that industry, even
mm-hmm.
though the colonizers are, I mean, colonizers are colonizers, tourists
yeah.
are tourists. Like, a lot can be said for
yeah.
how it's done correctly to not be colonizing, and how you can and shouldn't visit places, which is also a conversation I've been seeing a lot more right now.
Yeah. Very, very recent. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially because there's a lot going on in the world that,
mm-hmm.
like, white people especially are, like, not affected by. And so
yeah.
to, like, go to countries that are being heavy hit and, like, strained for resources because
yeah.
of things that we have caused, especially in America.
Yeah.
There's a very prominent conversation about
yep.
that right now. So that is on the forefront of my mind as I was doing this. I was like, interesting.
Yep.
So the reason we do not have these terraces anymore.
Hmm.
is because a big boom, boom, explosion, volcanic eruption.
Oh, well, I was worried it was going to be like, because the Victorians don't know how to treat things properly.
I mean, yes, I'm sure. But the earth was not kind to them either. In the days leading up to the eruption, people did know that there was a lot of activity in the geysers and some plumes and steam.
Mm-hmm.
And those living in the area noted appearances and like, happenings that
mm-hmm.
seemed to portend disaster in the area. There was guide Sophia, who 11 days before the eruption was out on the lake with 6 tourists when the water suddenly got really high in the lake, and then it fell again. And the claim, not just by guide Sophia, but everyone in the boat, including the tourist, claimed that they witnessed some sort of canoe designed for war that was very distinctive for its double hull, was heading out with 13 people in it, dressed in these like ceremonial flax robes with their hair and like feathers in the way, in the custom of funerary proceedings.
Huh.
And that the Maori interpretation was not only that there was tragedy.
It's like an omen.
It was, yeah, it's an omen. Yeah. But that this was also the spirits of deceased people being taken to Mount Tarawera to rest with their ancestors.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was like the Maori people in the boat and the tourists all confirmed that they saw it.
Interesting.
Yeah. And there was another instance where the local guide had taken people out and noted that the creeks they traveled in were suddenly just empty. Like, it was just muddy mess that no one could travel through. All the boats were kind of, like, stuck and everything, which is a sign of, like, volcanic. I mean, that happened in Pompeii as well. The rivers just dried up, like, out of nowhere, because that's what seismic activity can do. Appa's entertaining us with a mosquito hot catching scheme that he has put implicated.
Yeah, we'll see if he can follow through.
But after this, these like omens and everything, some of the guides were like, "Hey, no, we're not going near there anymore. Like something, this is an omen. This is bad, et cetera, et cetera." Even I believe it's guide Sophia. Like there were some natural occurrences, like honey or something like that, that appeared, and she was like, "No, I don't want any part of it. You know." And she ends up surviving when a lot of other people didn't.
Wow.
So maybe she was right, and it was an omen, and she needed to avoid it, but. After all of this pretense, these little murmurs and omens, comes the eruption.
Mm-hmm.
Mount Tarawera, preceded by a few pre-shocks in the early morning that broke some like items in the hotels and homes, which was not unheard of in the area. There was other seismic activity, but on 1886, June 10th, the eruption comes. In the early morning. It is a 5 on the volcanic explosivity index. Yeah. It kills at least 120 people, which means that it is the deadliest as well as the largest magnitude earthquake that's happened in New Zealand in the last 500 years or so.
Wow.
Definitely the worst since colonizers have, like, taken into the land. We're, paying attention, watching.
Yeah.
It's so big. That it creates a subsequent electrical storm.
Wow.
Like, and hurricane-level winds are created. Only 7 people that died out of the 120 are thought to be Maori, or were not Maori, sorry. Which is a large part because the tourists stayed in towns outside of the area and traveled in for the days to see it.
Yeah.
So in the early hours, most of them weren't there anymore. Right. The eruption itself lasted probably somewhere around 6 hours. And was heard all across the island. It caused like lightning, explosions, and the mud and ash covered somewhere around 15,000 square kilometers, which is almost 5,800 square miles.
Jeez.
It's huge.
Yeah.
And the human life that was lost in part was because it covered nearby villages and in this like debris and mud and ash. Mm-hmm. Not even like, oh, the people were like at the opposite age.
Right.
Which is the case in a lot of volcanic eruptions. It's that the runoff in the Lahar and everything, the pyroclastic flow is what really damages things and hurts people.
Yeah.
But it was a strong enough volcanic eruption that it expanded the lake and like created a valley, like a rift in the valley.
Wow.
And the area, there were areas and settlements that are completely buried, and you can still go see them.
Wow.
And search parties went back to look, but they were like, they could not really find any survivors. A hotel or two had collapsed, killing what was thought to be the last man who saw the terraces that day. And he was like, must have been on his porch watching the explosion because he was writing in his journal. And it's crazy because like, you hear like, unfortunately, people's like end of life sometimes get caught on like audio recordings or voicemail, and it's like you hear it happening in real time. But to half the time, you sit down and physically and write.
Yeah.
So it means he must have been watching, and they believe that as he was writing, he was basically saying like, "I don't know what's going to happen. We've been watching this explosion for hours," and then it kind of cuts off. That the balcony he was sitting on collapsed.
Yeah.
And it was a structural collapse that killed him rather than like a pyroclastic flow.
Jeez.
So that was like, oh, to me, I was like, that's like, you don't always think about that either. Right. Like that sometimes there is an instance where someone could write down their last words without it having to be like a time sensitive thing.
Yeah.
But the explosion itself, we don't know what it did to the terrorists, to the terraces.
Interesting.
Like, we don't know if it completely, the assumption was that they,
if they just
them
kind
to
of
pieces.
Buried them,
exactly.
Or if they, yeah, if they still exist under there.
If it was like part of the vent and
yeah.
they got blown off to high heaven,
mm-hmm.
we don't really know. And the suspicion for a long time was that it was, the explosion just blew them to pieces.
Yeah.
That, I mean, this explosion was big enough that it formed, like, the Waimangu Volcanic Rift Valley, like, a hydrothermal creation. Like, it was an incredibly strong, multifaceted explosion. It didn't just, like, blow the top off the volcano. It created a lot of new stuff, new
yeah.
symptoms in the earth. And the assumption was, from people who came back to visit the scene after they had already seen it, they were like, there is nothing left.
Yeah.
It's impossible to that there's anything that has survived. This area was so destroyed.
Yeah.
There's no semblance of any landmarks that we recognize. Nothing left. So everything's so drastically different that they were like, okay, it's just gone.
It's gone.
It's
yeah.
gone. And then it was just blown away into the rest of the world. But people thought they were missing for, you know, 100 years until very recently. There was an effort in 2011 with autonomous underwater vehicles to kind of go beneath Lake Rotomahana to see if there was anything left that could be like
yeah.
something, some semblance of
yeah.
the pink and white terraces. And this 2011 search happened 125 years after the eruption. So they weren't sure what they were going to find. Like,
yeah.
if there's any semblance of it left, if there was even anyone around there anymore that, like, maybe heard stories from their grandparents. Like, hey, this is what it looked like. This is how you could have gotten there, et cetera,
yeah.
et cetera.
Yeah.
So they're not dealing with, like, if you had gone to look with this technology right after the fact,
mm-hmm.
it would be a little bit easier than, like, 125
right.
years later.
Right, yeah.
So they were surprised that they thought they rediscovered part of it. That they thought they were looking at the two lowest tiers of the terraces, about 200 feet or 60 meters underneath the surface of the lake.
Huh.
That there were remnants that had just either fallen or the water levels
yeah.
had risen. Something yeah. so geologically catastrophic happened that it allowed them to just sink beneath the water
mm-hmm.
in some way, shape, or form. Detached or not, they weren't sure.
Yeah.
But it had been believed, like, for so long that they weren't really, like, basically you couldn't say, like, oh, this one has a U shape to it, so it's
right.
this section.
Right.
Or, oh, see that little dented wiggle? That's
uh-huh.
from the 1800s.
They couldn't, like, prove
yeah.
it. Yeah.
Yeah, there was nothing yeah. distinct to tell them, like, which part of the terrace that they might be looking at, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
et cetera. Just that this was the general semblance of that shell-like shape that
uh-huh.
made up the terraces. Even with those discoveries, a lot of people still kind of put it up for grabs. Some scientists suggested that the terraces, like, the catastrophic global, like movement, geological movement,
mm-hmm.
shifted the terraces to the other side of the lake, or went further down, or maybe didn't fall down as far as they thought. It's a very controversial conversation.
Yeah.
The team that found it in 2011 actually retracted some of their information. They were like, hey, you know what? We did, like, this wasn't solid enough evidence.
Yeah.
It is very likely that the terraces were destroyed and this is just a feature or a shape that looks
yeah.
similar.
Huh.
And that doesn't mean it's the end. There's plenty of people still looking for it to this day, and no one has been able to gather samples of the actual silica to prove that their theory is correct.
Yeah.
Some people legitimately think that it never sank below the water at all, that it's buried in dirt and
mm-hmm.
like feet of dust, because the nearest village where a bunch of the people died, the Maori people, Iwi people had died, was buried under like 4 to 5 feet of like
yeah.
dirt and ash. And
yeah.
you can see their homes. Like, if you go tour, you can see like their huts and their homes and stuff
yeah.
like that, sticking like just enough out of the ground that
uh-huh.
you can tell what they are. So it's not completely ridiculous to think that maybe the explosion just threw so much debris over them that we can't see them. And without someone there to like use those landmarks or recognize anything, that was the best they had.
Yeah.
But it is a little bit hard to think that something the size of like that many acres could just disappear and no one would be like, hey, that general shape of that mountain
right.
might be it. So
right.
it's a probability versus possibility kind of thing.
Interesting.
And there is still tourism encouraged by the pink and white terraces, even though they're not really there anymore. There's ways for people to take exploratory and sort of investigative tours to see mm-hmm. what's left, or kind of tour it and like see, oh, this is where this could have happened, or where this could be, or this mm-hmm. is where they thought they found this.
Yeah.
But the geothermal activity also didn't end there, and they rarely do. After the eruption, there was a geyser called the Weimangu geyser in 1900 that became active. It erupted to something like 450 meters high. Like, it was a massive eruption that in its own right was like geologically significant enough to draw tourists just to come see that. And the word that they use for the Weimangu, I believe, is how it's pronounced. It means black water, because that's what it would look like when it erupted. It threw sand and muddy rocks so ridiculously high that it looks like black water, which made me think of oil.
Yeah.
If you've ever seen all those old black pictures gold. In the West. Black gold. And for a while, that geyser was so reliable and could be held accountable that it erupted almost on the dot like every 36 hours or so. So it was easy for people to come and visit and say like, oh, I'm going to see this. It's not like, oh, I might see the Aurora Borealis tonight. It was like, yeah, if you want us to come by at this time, it'll give it an hour.
It'll be there. Yeah.
It was the biggest geyser for a while until one in Yellowstone started working its way up that ladder. And that's not to say that it was completely safe. And that's not to say that any geothermic investigation tourism stuff ever is. I mean, there's still people who like ignore warning signs and Yellowstone and stuff like that and get scalded all the time because like this is still nature and she is still more powerful than you.
And I think people have the idea that like, oh, it's a park, it's fine. No.
Or that like we're harnessed and safe from the world.
Like
we have not figured it all out, buddy.
No,
like
nature will win. Let me tell you something.
Like there could be a volcanic eruption right now that we never see coming and covers all of America in like black dust. It could literally happen.
It could.
And we just gotta remind ourselves. But there's definitely not as many safety precautions even then as there are now. It was still there was geothermic activity along that valley in 1903. Knowing that the geyser like was predictable and everything, a guide and the tourists accompanying them were caught in an unexpected eruption off of the normally scheduled clock when they were walking between the viewing areas to see the geyser, and they were actually swept away by the water.
Wow.
Because that's how much water comes out of a 450 meter eruption.
It's not like a drip.
No, it's not. And their deaths were commemorated by, I think there's like a wooden cross there now or something like that, or a marker, but At some point, it got a little less faithful and consistent, and it started with random eruptions until its last eruption in November of 1904, when the geyser went quiet as well. The geyser was kind of the last, like, oh, this is more of a touristy thing. There's a lot of, like, volcanic activity in the area, and there have, and obviously, like, since the original terraces were destroyed, there's been deaths and everything, but, like, it's one of those things that, like, we talked about the Seven Wonders a while ago, and that was really like neat and cool and fun.
Yeah.
And I really loved that.
Yeah.
And so many of them are destroyed by humans that this one, I was like, ugh, this would have been incredible. The Eighth Wonder, and it would have been natural.
Yeah.
It would have been naturally made, but it also made me feel like sometimes the only thing that can destroy that level of creation is
nature itself. Yeah.
So it kind of gave me a new outlook, because I was like, this is something that definitely, were it here today and now, would be the influencer, like, hotspot, I'm sure.
Every single for sure.
Influencer and their mother would be, like, at the terraces. It's kind of what is it, the salt pools or whatever in Iceland that are, like, really popular and stuff. And not to say I wouldn't go. Like, I would hella go if I could.
Oh, hell yeah.
But it is also a reminder to be respectful of the spaces we have. Yeah. Even if a volcano doesn't destroy them, it's our responsibility to leave no trace and you know take care of the spaces that you do have, and be careful, because you don't know when something's just gonna radically alter the landscape of the very ground you stand on.
Well, and then it also makes you wonder, like, how many places like that existed mm-hmm. that we will never know about because mm-hmm. it existed 50,000 years ago.
Yeah.
And 45,000 years ago, a volcano erupted and destroyed it, you know? And it's like, man. It's like,
okay. Well, and the sad thing is if you look up pictures of this thing, it's gorgeous. Yeah. Like the paintings.
I'm trying to decide. I'm sure I'm going to want to kill myself a little bit.
Yeah. Do it. Do it. Look it up right now. Yeah, yeah. Because it almost feels like, oh, cute. Pretty. And then you realize that these things are like acres and you're like, oh, because like a painting, you can see the dimensions, like the perspective a little bit, yeah. but like okay. you don't get the full impact until you're like, oh, these things could fit like multiple people in them. It's not like a little hot tub section. They're, it would have been beautiful. So it kind of makes me really sad. Like,
oh,
we
my
don't
God.
Have any like colored photos of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
But aren't they beautiful?
That's incredible. Oh my God. Yeah.
And it makes me sad too, because like, not only is there a whole like village of people that died being yeah. buried in their homes, but like this was like an ancestral thing to them.
Right.
And it got exploited and then destroyed.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It gives me all kinds of mixed feelings about Jeez. It, but it would have been beautiful. And I really wish it's something I could have seen. And like yeah. you said, it made me really think about like how many other like,
mm-hmm.
natural features are there that we have no concept of, not that yeah. we don't get to see, but that we have no concept of because yeah. they don't exist anywhere else.
Yeah. Like, well, and it's stuff like that where it's like, you know, you see those pictures and it's like the world's so weird, and it's true. There is all of these just bizarre geologic formations
yeah.
that happen because of whatever reason, the mm-hmm. timing, the what's it called?
Circumstances,
the conditions were yeah. just exactly right mm-hmm. to make these like phenomenal things
mm-hmm.
and it's like you don't really realize like, oh my God, like
yeah
yeah, it's just, it's incredible.
So many more
yeah
like I try to like picture in my head seashell shaped concave
yeah.
pools built on top of each other, and my brain can't fathom that.
No.
And so it's like, I'm sure there's other stuff in history that like I will never be able to even visualize in my head because mm-hmm. my brain doesn't understand that Earth and nature can make those
things. I know.
Things.
And it's just like,
ugh, so
you would never even think of, and you're like, that looks like an alien planet, but it's just our Earth. Planet. Yeah. Which, ugh, it's incredible.
So I felt like they deserve to be talked about, even though yeah. they're not there anymore, because I am waiting for the day that they're able to say like, hey, this is a thing.
Yeah.
Also, that just made me think real fast.
Uh-huh.
I should have said this at the beginning of last episode. I didn't realize that in January, they believe they have found Amelia Earhart's aircraft.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't mean to jump yeah. topics, because every few months, someone's like, yeah. I found Amelia Earhart.
Right.
But
yeah.
this,
but
like,
this is like kind of legit.
With sonar, they think they found like the model plane she yeah. was flying near the, like near a route to the island that like uh-huh. she was supposed to land on to
yeah.
get yeah. like, it's credible, and they're yeah. hoping to go back later this year and like find more evidence and proof and maybe yeah. even look for it. But like,
oh, I'm so glad you brought that up. I meant to ask you about it.
Yeah, yeah. No, this is like what made me think of it. Like, there's always going to be like, oh, we found this. Like, you yeah. can only just wait for the people who have the ability and the skill
and
to
the
do
right
it.
Technology.
Yeah. Because yeah. yeah. again, there are some things in history that people have every right to be like, hey, you know what? We're not going to do this. We're not going to look for this and risk damaging it more. We're going to wait till we have the technology to do this right.
Yeah.
And I would love to see that with this sort of thing.
Yeah.
So,
oh, that's so, that's such a good point. Yeah. Yeah. yeah.
But I would love to, I'm going to like stay tuned and see what scientists
comes
are saying
out of
about
that.
This.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if over the next few years, multiple people are like, hey, this and this. And someone's like, no, no, no,
yeah.
no, maybe this.
I mean, if the last time they really looked was in the 2010s, like early 2010s, then.
They've had people looking over the last few years, like 5 years, I saw some articles yeah. and stuff, but everyone's still like, it's above ground. No, it's under the water.
Yeah.
It's this and it's like, you can't even agree on that basic consensus.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's amazing.
Yeah. Ugh. Ugh. Well, I'm so glad you did that, because I had never heard of that. And that is so cool. And
I've been paying more attention to like geological stuff in
yeah.
history, because like
yeah.
people, events, all that's really cool. But I think it was when I was talking about the Nazca Lines, I was like, there's so much like in the earth
yes.
that we like leave or
yeah.
don't leave behind that
yeah.
like forms our histories.
Yes, absolutely.
So, yeah,
absolutely.
That was a fun one, but
yeah. yeah. Oh, well, good job. Good
Thank
job.
You.
Oh man. Okay, I have to come up with another recommendation.
And, I have mine.
Okay, go.
Last week I talked about Chicago World Fair.
Mm-hmm.
And I had mentioned that there's a movie with Benedict Cumberbatch and Tom Holland. Mm-hmm. I do actually recommend it. I remember my dad and I went to go see it when it came out a few years ago. It was so maybe my taste for the movie was informed by my
little bit of rose-colored glasses on it. Yeah,
my fun night out with my dad to go see a movie and stuff like that. But I thought it was pretty good, and it did a good job, I think, of switching up the narrative of just like people like in their like inventors in their laboratory, like aha, light bulb moment, literally. I got the light bulb to work. But like how cutthroat inventing and academia and research is, because we kind of overlook that sometimes.
Yeah,
but these people were like ready to sabotage each other for like the money. Like they knew that they were on the precipice of a groundbreaking worldwide discovery, and what they were willing to do to get it. It's called The Current Wars.
Yeah.
But it was a good cast and pretty well written, and I really liked it. And I felt like it helped me understand the, like, you know, we get the history narrative of like, oh, so and so invented the light bulb. It's like, no, they didn't. So and so did. So and so stole it. He got it back.
Yeah.
He sabotaged him. He trash talked him to the media. He got him discredited. Like, it's so dramatic. So I actually really liked it, and I would recommend that movie.
Nice. Okay. Cool. I haven't seen it, but you know me with movies. It's not great.
I know you're also not a big fan of like drama, like like drama versions of history.
Yeah.
This one's not super like, it's not war dramatic or anything like that, but it is like, I am watching
a drama. Yeah.
Yeah.
I am going to recommend, what am I going to recommend? I'm going to recommend, everyone should have a lava lamp. That's what I'm going to recommend. Yeah. Lava lamps are a good time, and they just add a bit of fun and funkiness to your house. So I recommend a good lava lamp.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Kat is eating a chip. So, because she's eating a chip, I'm going to go ahead and get started on mine.
I really wanted the salt.
Yeah, you got to have the chip. Okay. So, as I mentioned earlier, I'm going to be doing kind of an overview of Valentine's Day and how it originated and how it got to where it is now.
A lot of bad things happen on Valentine's
Day. So let's get into it, including the guy it's named after because he's Saint Valentine's. And, like, notably, saints don't really die in great ways. And that's kind of the whole point. So.
Have you seen that? I cannot remember what show it is, but she's, like, listing off, like, female, like, heroes, like notable women from history. She's like, Joan of Arc, so-and-so. She's like, wow, women who do stuff tend to die a lot.
I haven't seen it, but like, that's funny. Yeah.
For a day that's about love, a lot of bad things happen.
I know. And it's just kind of like, okay. Mm-hmm. It, from what I saw, it's kind of like, but we'll get into it. But it kind of seems like there were several things happening at once, and it just ended up being for that day. So let's talk about St. Valentine's Day itself. And St. Valentine is a canonized Catholic saint. Actually, the Catholic Church recognizes at least three different saints named Valentine or Valentinus, all of whom were martyred. So, yes. So the actual, like, St. Valentine, like, his story is also, like, in and of itself is kind of, like, legend, and, like, people don't super know what the actual story of it is because it's a long time ago. One legend says that Valentine was a priest who served during the 3rd century in Rome. So around 270 is, like, the pretty accepted date of when this guy dies. Emperor Claudius II decides that single men were better soldiers than men with wives and families. So he actually outlaws marriage for young men.
Okay.
Valentine was like, that's not fair. Like, defied the emperor and continued to perform marriages for young lovers in secret.
Aww.
That to me is like a really romanticized version of the story.
Probably not that.
I don't super buy that one.
But it would make sense where we get that balance.
Yeah, how it's like associated romance with love, right? Yeah. Like, that makes sense. So, of course, when Claudius discovers that he was doing this, he orders Valentine to be put to death because you can't have someone defying the emperor's orders. This one is the one I saw the most, and I think it's probably the more accepted one. Another version of this story is that St. Valentine was a man who was... he was basically killed for attempting to help Christians escape Roman prisons, where they faced really brutal conditions and were beaten and tortured. And the legend says that Valentine, when he was arrested, he was shown mercy by the jailer's daughter, and that he even was able to, like, she was blind and he was able to cure her blindness, which is like a classic Christian, you know.
That shows up in the Bible.
Miracle.
A lot.
Yeah. But so they kind of fall in love, and that he actually originates the first Valentine, quote unquote, by writing her a letter that he signed from your Valentine as a farewell before his execution.
Oh.
Yes.
Either way. Cute, but ugh.
It's still like, that's the story that I buy a little bit more. I think the from your Valentine connection is forced just to get some sort of like love thing happening here.
Uh-huh.
But it seems like a more believable story from start to finish than the first one for me.
I would kind of agree with that.
So regardless, Claudius killed Valentine. He gets sanctified in the Catholic Church, and St. Valentine's Day is placed on February 14th. Now, people think that the Catholics probably decided to place Valentine's Day in the middle of February and where they do in an effort to Christianize a celebration called Lupercalia, which is a pagan tradition from the Romans.
That is something that they love to do.
Yes. So I believe this too.
Merry Christmas, everyone.
Yeah. This is actually celebrated at the Ides of February. So the middle of February, or February 15th. It was a fertility festival. So there's that connection again, that love. And this is what I mean by saying, like, it just seemed like there was a lot kind of happening at one time. And they just decided, yes, that is going to be the love day, even though horrible things have happened.
Like, what a wonderful coincidence. Everyone's talking about love and romance and sex and reproduction, and we're just going to go with it.
Yep. This is a festival dedicated to Faunus, who was the Roman god of agriculture, as well as to the Roman founders Romulus and Remus. So this festival involved members of the Luperci, which was an order of Roman priests. They would go to a sacred cave where they believed the infants Romulus and Remus were born, or were raised by the she-wolf who raised them. They would then sacrifice a goat for fertility and a dog for purification. And then they would go to the town and essentially slap all of the women. I'm not kidding. And like farmers and crops with the fertility and the purification skins of the animals. So, this was like, people enjoyed doing this. They were like, it's going to make me fertile. So it was just part of, like,
you know
what you did.
You do what you got to do.
You do what you got to do. You know what? It's like,
I don't get
what
it,
else are you going to do?
But okay.
What else are you going to do is my thing.
I don't understand.
Can't say that I would super love to have, like, goat blood all over me to make me fertile. But you know what? I'm not ancient Rome.
I'm not ancient Rome, and fertility is not my thing. So you know what? Like, I'll just take your word for it. You do you.
Yeah. So there's a professor at Yale, a religious studies professor at Yale, named Noel Linsky. And he was like, this was basically, like, a good time for them. He says they were, quote, drunk. They were naked.
They wanted an excuse to party.
That young women would line up for men to hit them. Like, it was just a party. It was an excuse to kind of, just let loose a little.
I'm getting different vibes than I thought I was going to, but
So after this kind of ritual took place in the morning, the celebration continued on by sort of like a like a lottery, because all of the women would place their names in a big urn. This is the festival they did every year. Would place their names in a big urn, and the city's bachelors would choose a name, and then they would become paired together for the rest of the year. And then some people got married and some people didn't. Like, it was like a big matchmaking.
I was gonna say, it's like a, what are they called? Key parties or whatever? Where you, like, put your keys in a bowl and you have to, like, leave with whoever, like, is key you draw from
I mean, essentially, except I don't think they were swingers.
Oh, I thought that's what you meant, that they were, like, supposed to, like...
No, these are like, all, like, the unwed, like, yeah, bachelors and bachelorettes. Like,
reproductive. Oh. But,
swingers,
non,
yes.
Okay,
yeah.
Not already committed. Okay,
yes, yeah.
No, I was thinking yeah. more from the, like, hey, random moment, but do you want to, like,
hook no, up? No, no, gotcha. No, yeah. This is, yeah. All so the all the bachelors and the bachelorettes would do this. Yes, they would. They were. You know what? Why not?
Lit on the edge.
Yeah.
Also, just protect yourself, though. Don't actually just... have a lot of unprotected sex, like, please take precautions.
Yes this of course was deemed unchristian.
No, really,
I can't imagine the why like I can't imagine why. What? Shocker, I know. Pope Gelasius declared that it was unchristian, and then he also was like, and now there's this Saint's Day here. Stop doing that. Do this instead.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. So
yet another motif we see.
Yeah.
A lot in early revising of holidays.
Yes. So Linsky, the professor I mentioned earlier, he basically goes on to say in the article that I was reading, he was like, well, they did that. But it didn't really change anything, except they just put clothes back on during it. They weren't naked. So it was like, it was just, they were doing all the same thing.
Still
but
partying.
His quote is, quote, but the Christians put the clothes back on it. That didn't stop it from being a day of fertility and love. So from the beginning, this time in February is associated with fertility and love and springtime and all of those things. Mm-hmm. And so it just happened to be that St. Valentine's Day got placed on that day. It's kind of like Christmas in that way, where it's just like, yes, this is what we're going to celebrate on this day because that's what all the pagans are doing. And we have to make them stop doing that. But we can't really make them stop doing that. So we have to pretend like they are doing something Christian. At the same time, Normans had a celebration or had a yearly festival holiday called Gallatin's Day. And Gallatin meant, quote, lover of women. There wasn't a whole lot about this, but it's likely that since it was around the same time and Gallatin kind of sounds like Valentine, that they also got kind of conflated. And then eventually all of these traditions just melded into what would become Valentine's Day.
I do love that, like, just sheer coincidence, there's
what going on. That's basically what this is. Yeah, because it's like there's nothing in the actual Valentine's story or anything really that's happened on that day that would make it this like big love holiday, you know what
it's
I
just
mean
a bunch of like coincidences all lined up.
Yes, exactly. So it wasn't until the 14th and the 15th century with the popularization of the idea of courtly love, which this I kicked myself because I was like, I would have done that episode instead of this one, but it's fine because I will do it and it will be great. And I had never actually, it had never occurred to me to actually do an episode on courtly love, but it would definitely be really, really interesting to get into that. Because that's like a whole social history, cultural history thing. So I promise I will do that. But I was just like, wow, that never occurred to me to do a courtly love episode.
That would be a cool episode.
Courtly love became really popular in the 14th and the 15th century, and this is also, like, it was commonly believed in England and France at the time that February 14th was the beginning of the birds' mating season. So this coupled with the courtly love thing, we kind of get, like, the love birds idea.
Oh.
And so this is kind of, like, re-emphasized that, like, Valentine's Day and the season surrounding it should be, like, the love season because we're seeing, like, spring and birds mating and courtly love.
It's also not so cold, so if you're running around naked, I guess it's not quite so miserable.
Right. See, to me, you know, you have to, like, hunker down for warmth together. I mean, February is a cold month, so.
That's true.
It could be it, too.
I guess it's geographically depends. Geographically depends. If you want more of a snuggle romance, you move up north.
Yep. So the first time we actually see like recorded association of Valentine's Day with romantic love is written down by none other than Geoffrey Chaucer. He He's the first one who that's we have record of the association of romantic love with Valentine's Day.
You know, for some reason, that absolutely does not surprise
no,
me.
No, not at all. I've seen, what's that movie? Why am I blanking on it? Of course I am.
A Knight's Tale.
Yes, thank you.
I knew what you were thinking about.
I was like, I could picture the cover in my head. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. So in 1382, he writes a sonnet called Parliament of Fowls, which, yes, was a dream vision portraying a parliament for birds to choose their mates. Now, hold on.
I know.
So I'm not going to read the Middle English version of it. No, I'm going to spare us all from that.
No, you're good. I only know that it's like a romance poem thing. Like, reason, Parliament of the Fowls, all I know is that it's like a romance thing.
Yeah.
I've never read it.
I've never read it either. I've actually never even heard of it. But the modern English of it is, quote, "For this was on St. Valentine's Day, when every bird comes there to choose his match of every kind that men may think of. And that so huge a noise they began to make, that earth and air and tree and every lake was so full that not easily was there space for me to stand, so full was all the place." So by him saying that, like, this whole birds falling in love and mating, this, like, imaginary parliament mm-hmm. of birds doing that is on St. Valentine's Day. It's, like, the first time that love, romantic love, was conflated with mm-hmm. Valentine's Day that we have in, like, the written history, like, historical record. So
That's
pretty cool. Now, what is absolutely fascinating is the actual concept of Valentine's Day cards is
Hallmark.
Super... No, it's, like, 1400.
Oh, really?
Yes.
My guess is just always Hallmark.
Yeah. So, in the Middle Ages, handmade paper cards became really, really, really popular. And they kind of stayed popular throughout, like, the Victorian era. Like, you can actually, it's a big, I've seen it on TikTok a lot lately, making, like, the Victorian love cards. Have you seen that? Because you, like, fold them in a certain way. Yeah, you should. Yeah. And it's, like, really complicated and everything.
Surprised I haven't seen that with the
song. Yeah, it seems like it's kind of your content.
I'm, like, abhorrent of anything romantic right now.
The oldest known Valentine, like, actual Valentine's card that we would consider a Valentine's card, was written in 1415 by Charles, Duke of Orleans, or this is French, so Orléans, to his wife, who was imprisoned in the Tower of London.
What?
Oh, no. He was imprisoned in the Tower of London.
This took a very different turn.
Yes, he was captured at a battle. So it's in French, but it's, quote, "Je suis déjà d'amour tonné, ma très douce Valentine." So, Valentine. It's been a while since I've been in French. So, something. I love you. You're my Valentine.
That's cute.
Yeah. So, the earliest one that we have in English surviving was written in 1477 by Marjorie Bruce to her future husband, John Paston. And she calls him her, quote, "my right well beloved Valentine." Yeah, which I thought was cute. So I left it in. And then Valentine's Day is actually mentioned in Hamlet by Ophelia. And this is like 1600 that we have an early mention of it. This history is a lot like...
This feels very piecemeal.
It's also like, obviously it was popular enough to stay in kind of like the zeitgeist way earlier than I would think. Because if I had to date it, I would be like, 1700s is probably when Valentine's Day really became a thing.
Yeah, but for it to have staying power, but no, like, origin, no, like, significant.
And it also, like, looks the same that it looks now. Like, Valentine's cards.
Yeah.
People were sending Valentine's Day cards in 1450. Like,
that's a good point.
Crazy to me. Like, this specific mention of Valentine's Day in Hamlet is from Act 4, Scene 5, saying, quote, "Tomorrow is St. Valentine's Day. All in the morning be time, and I am made at your window to be your Valentine. Then up he rose and donned his clothes and dupped the chamber door. Let the maid in, that out a maid never departed more." So, yeah. Actually, the roses are red. rhyme. So roses are red, violets are blue. Yeah. That traces its origins from an epic written by Edmund Spenser called The Fairy Queen in 1590. And it comes from a verse in the epic that reads as, quote, "It was upon a summer shiny day when Titan Fairy his beams did display in a fresh fountain fair from all men's view. She bathed her breath with the boiling heat to lay. She bathed with roses red and violets blue, and all the sweetest flowers in that forest grew." This would eventually evolve into that, like, roses are red, violets are blue by the 1700s. And, of course, we all are familiar with that today. Now, as far as, like, getting to where we are now and, like, the modern conception of Valentine's Day, we do kind of see it just kind of evolve as modern history evolves.
Yeah.
So in 1797, there is a British publisher that issued a, like, I guess a volume, a book or a magazine, kind of like precursor, called The Young Man's Valentine Writer, which contains scores of sentimental verses for the young lover unable to compose his own.
Oh, that's so cute.
Yeah.
It's like, it's basically Reddit for, like, dating advice.
Here's some pickup lines. But in 1797, they're all like, "Oh, my lady.
Dost thou show thy ankles?"
That's a little salacious for the time. Look, if that's not a pickup line, that's a get you slapped in the face line.
That's true. That's true. Be careful. Yeah, boys, don't use that one. Girls, don't use that one. Anyone in between, don't use that one. We are not advocating for you to get slapped over someone's ankles.
So as we move into the 19th century, we see paper valentines becoming incredibly popular in England. So popular that they were assembled in factories to be sold. And as the Industrial Revolution, like, advances, the production of these is, like, skyrocketing. Okay. Fancy valentines, like, the fanciest among them were made with real lace ribbons and paper lace that was introduced in the mid-1800s. We know for a fact in 1835, 60,000 Valentine's cards were sent by post the United Kingdom. But what made this pretty significant was that postage was really expensive. So these people really had to want to send this card. Yeah. So, like, that's why we know, like, this is such, like, a thing in our history. And it's just so bizarre to me because it feels like,
I know,
it just doesn't seem like it would have such a kind of long history and for it for to, like, look the same.
Yeah.
Like, if I went back to 1835 and I said Valentine's Day, someone would,
like, "Oh, did you send a card?"
Yeah, exactly. "Oh, did you get a card?" No.
Like, what?
Yeah. What's interesting is in 1840, there was a reduction in postal rates, that were caused by some government guys, postal, like, reform bill. So this actually, because postage was cheaper, this saw the number of Valentine's Day in, like, a Valentine's Day's cards mailed in 1840. So remember, 35 had 60,000. Five years later, right after the lowering of the cost of post, 400,000 were sent. Yes. So these people were wanting to send them, but they just couldn't afford it.
Oh,
yeah.
That's kind of sweet.
Yeah. So what's not so sweet is that with the lowering and also, like, the wider availability of Valentine's, because we're moving into the industrial era and obviously there's a market for this, so they're being industrialized. That meant it was a little bit cheaper, so you could do things that maybe weren't so well-intentioned with them. So this, for the first time, made it possible for people to exchange cards anonymously.
Oh.
Which, for, like, people who do this history, apparently around this time, like, all of a sudden, there are some cards that are a little bit racy.
And they think Comstock laws.
Right. They think it's probably because, like, one, the cost of postage was cheaper, and two, you could send it anonymously and have no consequences. So all of a sudden we get popped up of these a little bit more salacious and scandalous Valentine's cards that aren't, like, so sweetly intentioned, which I think is really, really fascinating from a sex history standpoint.
Yeah. The anonymity has always, like, emboldened people.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And also just, like, you know, were all the Valentine's cards before that only about love? And the only reason, like,
when you think about
what caused, like, a sudden, like,
I'm sure it's not, because courtly love, like, was not as, like, innocent and proper. It's like, it was like, hey, you down to clown? Like,
literally,
especially if it was a court jester. But, like, no, like, and again, like, you've said it before on this podcast, because, like, this is your specialty, like, it's never as simple as a movie or book would portray it. It is far more complex. So it's like, I have no doubt that there was someone who's like sending, didn't have to be like explicit pictures or something like that. For it to be like, my mother should not read this. Like, I hope my nurse did not intercept my mail.
Yeah. And we have this concept that, like, oh my God, they were also like, no one knew what sex was, blah, blah, blah. No, that's not true.
Yeah.
They were humans just the same. It just didn't get written down because that wasn't proper, you know?
That's proper.
So going across the ocean to the United States, we actually have, like, there's one woman responsible for the boom in the popularity of, or the, like, for the creation of the first mass-produced Valentine's cards in 1847. So Esther Howland was the daughter of her father was already a card maker. And, and so she was from Worcestershire, Massachusetts, and she received a Valentine's card from a business associate of her father's. And this cracks me up, because instead of, like, responding to it as, like, oh, I got a Valentine, she was like, oh, that's a good business idea.
Hey, this lady, her mind was in the right spot.
I love that. She's a girl boss.
She was like,
she's a working woman.
Thanks for the romance. I have a business idea. I need to go. I have a proposal to go write up.
Hold on. I need to talk to my father. She imported paper lace and floral decorations from England, and soon enough became, like, the supplier for America, and kind of brought the whole popularization over from England. And then in 1868, Cadbury created fancy boxes, which were decorated boxes of chocolates in the shape of a heart for Valentine's Day. And that's where we get the association of Valentine's Day and chocolate.
Didn't Cadbury cream eggs become, like, illegal a few years ago or something like that? Or is that Kinder eggs?
It's Kinder. It's not Cadbury. Yeah.
Cadbury are the really expensive ones that I can't afford.
Oh, Cadbury's good, though. But if you catch them, like, after a holiday and they're, like, on 50% off.
Worth it? Okay. I'll get myself some this year.
So I thought that was really interesting because, again, I mean, now we're kind of getting into the time where, like, okay, that makes sense, especially because a lot more than you realize comes from advertising from 1850 to, like, 1920, 1930. Like, a lot more than you would even think about is just some marketing campaign that people actually believed, because you can't blame them, because this is the first time that, like, marketing has existed.
And we don't have, like, not that we don't have media literacy, but it doesn't look the same as what we have now.
Exactly. So that surprises me less. But it is interesting. That's how we kind of got the association there. And so that kind of brings us to the present. The U.S. Greeting Card Association estimates that every year there's about 190 million Valentine's cards that are sent around the U.S. About half of those they think are given to family members, other than husband or wife. It's a lot of, like, parents giving them to children and that kind of stuff. Now, if you include the cards that kids give in the classroom, the number goes from 190 million to 1 billion.
That doesn't surprise me.
No.
Because, like,
because if you have a class of 20 and everyone's bringing 20 Valentine's.
400.
That's a big number.
Yeah.
More than 400.
And then there's, like, 10 kindergarten classes in each school.
Yeah.
10 schools in each district.
Yep. Yeah.
Like, 2 districts in each city. Like, that's insane.
Yep. And
I won't lie, it seems like so, like, not wasteful, but after your mention of, like, conscious consumption, I'm like,
I do have a little bit at the end about, like, Valentine's Day and consumerism.
Because, like, honestly, yeah, it was kind of fun in elementary school to have a little shoebox.
Well, I mean, if they're, like, paper, then it's not as bad.
Sometimes lollipops attached to them.
Oh, those were the good ones. You go on without candy, what are you doing?
I know.
So this just kind of, like, by default makes teachers actually the one group of people that receive the most Valentine's Day.
Oh. Yeah. That's kind
of
sweet.
Yeah. Now, of course, with, as you mentioned, kind of like the consumerism and the commercialization that has taken over this holiday, Valentine's Day is kind of considered by a good chunk of people to be a, quote, Hallmark holiday.
Yeah.
That, and if you don't know what that is, it's essentially the idea that Hallmark makes up a bunch of holidays just to sell cards, like Mother's Day, Father's Day. Not saying that those aren't worthy of celebrating, right, but, right, like, probably would not be in as much focus as they are now without Hallmark. So this is why I wanted to talk about, like, the kind of consumption, overconsumption that can come from Valentine's Day, because as you kind of go into the store and you see the big giant stuffed animals and the cards and the chocolate, and they're all wrapped in plastic, and it's just, it's, you kind of see, and especially because things that are so specific to one event,
yeah,
are really hard to kind of have, like, a longer lasting thing.
Yeah, you throw, like, stores throw them out when they're done.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I went to Goodwill yesterday to drop some stuff off, and it was just clothes and stuff for me, but the guy in front of me had, like, two giant stuffed animals, and I'm sure it was, like, some sort of Valentine's Day thing.
Yeah.
And it's just, like, you see that a lot, so I just wanted to kind of bring that back around to the conversation of, like, just being a little bit more conscious when you're consuming things. This was earlier today for us, but it was last week's recommendation for me, was just kind of, like, instead of just kind of intentionally consuming things, like, doing slower paced stuff. It's easy to get caught up in holidays, but if you can make something for, if you do have a Valentine, if you want to give something to your family, making something for them can often be more meaningful and a lot better for the planet, especially if you're using stuff that you already have. Like, I have a shit ton of yarn over there. I could crochet, like, my friend, like, a little something and be like, happy Valentine's Day, you know?
Yeah.
It's more meaningful and it's better for everyone, especially because studies have done that says that February 14th by itself represents an increase of 9 million kilograms of CO2.
Oh my God.
On top of everything that's, like, kind of standard on a daily practice. And this comes from the food, the fresh cut flowers are a really big contributor to this. Balloons.
Oh, I didn't think about the flower impact.
I know. And it breaks my heart because I love flowers.
Well, like, and there's something you said too for, like, it's like talking to people about, like, hey, don't throw out this and this. There's something you said for that. Yeah. But, like, big business who takes advantage of that, like, they're the ones who should be more responsible in producing.
Oh, absolutely.
This stuff,
not overproducing.
Oh, and I'm not knocking on you.
Yeah.
It's like frustrating because it's like, it comes down to us to do something about it.
Well, and this is not to say, too, that you're a bad person for engaging in a holiday. Absolutely not.
No.
It's like, we are never going to,
we're never going to offset.
But it's still a good practice to be in.
Oh, yeah.
To just kind of think critically about what you're consuming.
Oh, yeah.
And what time of year might lead you to overconsuming things that you wouldn't normally do.
Yeah.
Not saying that you have to, like, I'll buy myself flowers every day. You know, like, I'm not going
to,
like, I'm not going to stop doing that. But it's just kind of like, maybe I won't also buy a box of chocolates. You know what I mean?
Well, you're 100% right. Like, there's that level of, like, consumerism that's you should be conscious. We should be conscious of everything that we consume.
Yeah.
And it's so easy to, like, not think about it until you're, like, in it.
Yeah.
But it's, like, disappointing and sad, like you said, because it's, like, I don't know.
It's like you want to celebrate it.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of people, the alternative being that they do, like, experience-based stuff together now.
Yeah. That's a really big, so it's not to say you have to cut it out, but just, you know, think it's a helpful practice to think about everything that you're consuming, especially, and also why you're consuming it.
Yeah.
You know, like, if you have a partner who isn't really into Valentine's Day, maybe instead of buying them all the typical Valentine's Day whatevers, you're like, hey, let's go to the park.
Yeah.
Let's go to a concert. Let's go do something.
Mm-hmm.
instead of like, I'm going to give you 20 stuffed animals you don't need,
yeah,
you know,
that you're going to keep for a few months and yeah. have to get rid of yeah. some space. Yeah.
So, or maybe, and if you do have a partner that really enjoys all of that stuff, then go for it. But just making sure that like, it's good quality stuff you're buying and it's mm-hmm. going to be appreciated and lasted.
It's
and
not like throwaway gifts.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And I wanted to kind of wrap up on all of the kind of interesting things that have happened on Valentine's Day. I'll start from the oldest and get to, well, I'm going to save one for last, which Kat has actually kind of touched on before. but in 1884, on Valentine's Day, Teddy Roosevelt's mom and wife die.
Yep.
In 1931, the film adaptation of the book Dracula was released.
Really?
On Valentine's Day. And in 1991, keeping the theme of horror movies, Silence of the Lambs was released on Valentine's Day.
Wow.
Could you imagine going on a date to Valentine, like a Valentine's Day movie date?
And someone's just like,
and you're going to see Silence of the Lambs. And then, of course, most infamously is the 1929 mm-hmm. St. Valentine's Day Massacre in Chicago, ordered by Al Capone himself. Yes. And that is kind of the history of Valentine's Day.
Wow. I think yeah. it also may have been the first time a president was photographed.
Oh, really? I didn't see anything
been,
like that.
I think it might have been James Polk.
Interesting.
For some reason that like huh. you said Al Capone and I thought about it for a second. I was like, there's something else with the photograph. I think
interesting.
I think it's, I could be wrong about that. In yeah. fact, I probably am. Disregard that. but like,
it's okay. I was convinced that also another massacre had happened on Valentine's Day, but it's actually another Saint's Day.
Oh,
well, I don't know. Maybe I should have Googled weird things that have happened on Valentine's Day, but instead I was just looking at like all of the this days in history things.
Oh,
so
yeah.
maybe that's something you could do on your own. Google weird things that have happened on Valentine's Day.
That's actually. If someone gave me that as a gift, I would prefer it so much to any other gift. If someone's like, hey, for Valentine's Day, I made you a list of all the weird historic events and like put it in a picture, like a list, I would frame it and make
oh,
it
oh, dude, that would be so, like if it was like kind of like a cool graphic design
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, that would be my perfect
that would
Valentine's
be good.
Day gift.
That would be good. All right, Kat's future partner,
yeah,
listen
you
up.
Know what it is.
Listen
you know
up.
What to do.
Yep.
You know what to do.
Oh man.
Wow.
So okay.
Well, that
yeah.
was fun. Okay.
It was a good. It was a solid episode.
Yeah. I enjoyed that, and I definitely learned some stuff today. Because I did not know that it was so long-standing of a tradition.
Yeah,
to
me
send
neither.
Cards and stuff.
Yeah.
Like they still in recognizable form.
Yeah.
Existed like
yeah,
that.
Yeah. So. Exactly. Like I said, you could go to someone in the 1450s and be like. Yeah, you know what a Valentine's Day card is? They're like, yeah, I sent one the other day.
And you'd be like, well, no one sent me one. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, 1450s peasant.
Making me feel bad about myself.
What are you good for?
well, hopefully y'all are doing better than a 14th century peasant.
I hope we all are. Although that is questionable nowadays, honestly.
Don't ask Elmo. He
he had a rough week.
He had a rough week. So, yeah, you don't have to send us, you know, a 14th century peasant letter with a pigeon or whatever they use back
although
then.
That would be appreciated.
Yeah.
Maybe instead, you can compose one in our inbox or on
yes.
Twitter.
Yep. TANAHL podcast.
Is the Twitter. And then this is not a history lecture is at gmail.com is our email. We would appreciate the outpouring of
yes.
love for us this Valentine's Day.
Yeah. Yeah. Any more weird Valentine's Day facts we missed, we want to hear them. And in the meantime, hopefully you, whether or not you are with a partner, you have fun and you do something nice for yourself.
Yep.
Everyone deserves that. My dog and I will be watching The Corpse Bride.
Hell yeah.
Per tradition, I believe. And eating an entire H-E-B coffee cake on our own. It is
yay!
A tradition I live for every year. So
it's okay. I will be hosting that event. That our
oh,
friend
that
and I host
thing.
Yep. Yep.
Uh-huh.
Weekly. So really romantic for both
oh,
of us.
I should go to that.
Yeah, I should go to that.
Yeah.
It'll be
okay.
fun.
yeah. Well, in the meantime, everyone else, enjoy your sort of holiday and we'll see you next time. And in the meantime.
Yeah.
This
has
not been
a
history
lecture.
Bye.
Bye.